Barak from Central European University of Budapest. Professor Barat is professor for gender studies and social linguistics at University of Szeged in Hungary, and she is the chief editor, or editor-in-chief, which is much a difference to chief editor, editor-in-chief of the Hungarian e-journal TNTEF, an interdisciplinary journal for gender studies. And she is not only the editor-in-chief, but she's also the founder, she told me. Yeah. There are 5 issues now on the web. Her research interests cover critical studies of discourse, relational models of identity, the relationship between language, power, and ideology, and feminist critical theory. And she told me some minutes ago that she is the translator or the Hungarian voice of Judith Butler. She translated Bodies That Matter and most recently her speech for the Adorno Prize. There are a lot of publications, and some which I want to let you know are, which are in relationship to the speech today, are the Theorist Feminist, Strategies of Gatekeeping in Hungaria Print Media. And this is printed in a volume called Feminist Critical Discourse, Analysis, Gender, Power, and Ideology in Discourse, from 2005 at Palgrave, which is a very famous American publisher. Then, Queer in Hungary, Hate Speech Regulation, Queering the Speech Conduct Binary. And this is in a volume, Queer in Europe, Contemporary Case Studies. Another project on queer is Queering the Intersection of Legislative, Religious, and Higher Educational Exclusion, Revisiting the First Case of Collective LGBT litigation in Hungary. In a volume, which very interesting title, it's Transport of Queer Theory. And last but not least, she has submitted a volume, an edited volume on the, with the title Ideologische, this is the German version.
Ideological? Yeah.
Thanks. Conceptualizations of Language, Discourse of Linguistic Diversity. She is also the European coordinator in the EIGE project. And this is a project which does a platform in action from the Beijing Women's Conference. And this is a project, Women and Media in the European Union. And next term, she will be the Käthe Leichner Guest Professor at the University of Vienna. And today, we hear something very political, actual speech, or at least for me, a very, very interesting to hear so something from the very actual political situation in Hungary, which makes me a little, at least, afraid. And the speech
is... You're not
is,
the only one.
The speech is entitled Reimagining Identity Politics, How to Approach Ethnic Segregation of the Roma in Hungarian Educational Policies. Mm-hmm. And thank you for coming, and I'm really looking forward to hear your speech.
Okay, so above all, I should say thank you for the invitation, and I'm also impressed that anyone is awake at 8 o'clock for a talk, right? It's really unusual in my experience, so this is also a challenge. So that's the extra, I would say, the special treat on top of the invitation, right? And also, for a personal note, it's really funny that I would have never imagined that I would visit Marburg with the church named after this Hungarian saint whose name I was given to live with for the rest of my life. So it was really funny when I realized that anyway. No, it's enough for me, or whichever way is better. No, you can go down that much because if I need it, but I don't need it. There is also this local light here, but I really don't need it. It's enough. Okay. Now, what I would really like to say is that that this talk is something that reflects the beginning of a new research interest in my life. Okay, and the decision actually was really motivated by serial homicide cases 4 years ago, 3 years ago against Roma families, like blind hitting one after the other, just to frighten them. And also because those cases have not been brought to a conclusion yet in the Hungarian legislative system, whereas when it is people of Roma origin who happen to be taken to court, their cases are immediately decided on without any due and attentive procedure. Okay, so and I went, at one point there was a civil organization to go along to the funeral of the last victim, a father who was shot dead with his 3-year-old son. He was running away with protecting him in his arms, and like 4,000 of us went along to demonstrate, sort of like to say that, like, on one hand, like, we're terribly sorry, we apologize, but on the other hand, also, like, not all Hungarians are a threat for you. So, anyway, so this is why I thought, like, I have to do something about the rampant racism in Hungary. Okay. But at the same time, I'm a feminist scholar. So, and how to bring these two together. And also because my major interest is in understanding how meaning is changing, okay? So what brings about changes to meaning? What brings about changes to our concepts, to how we understand the world, and consequently how we try to make our moves in this world? So therefore, what I'm mostly interested in is, like, categories, concepts. And the most important category I'm interested in, of all, is identity. And what I see in feminist scholarship, especially when I read queer studies, is that identity is usually sort of, like, demonized or stigmatized for being stigmatizing. Okay, so in that sense, I would like to reclaim this category. Okay, I would like to make all of us aware that we deal in categories on a daily basis. So and my impression usually is as if it were way too convenient for researchers to think that the only problematic category is identity, as if identity were the only category, and we forget about all the other categories, whereas in actual fact, every statement we make is articulated in and through categories. Okay? So in that sense, maybe it is more important for me to say that what I am focusing on today is the politics of identity as a category, okay? The politics of identity category, or to see, okay, which dimensions of potentially multiple identity or an intersectional understanding of identity is pushed to the forefront in contemporary public discourses of Hungary, okay? and whether this is more of an identity of race, and therefore what to do with the other potential dimension of an identity, i.e. gender, okay, gender relations. So what I'm also trying to say that categories are socially embedded, therefore they have got a history. That's one thing. And the other is that because of this embeddedness, okay, not all potential dimensions of identity are of equal relevance or relevant at all at a given social moment. Okay, so this is what the talk is going to be about. The other thing I would like to say in advance for framing it and to make it hopefully easier for you to follow is that my most important category, that's what I have become most familiar with over the years, I would say over the past 12 years, is discourse, okay? But discourse, for me, is not something that could be synonymous with language or text, right? So I understand discourse more like an interface, more like the intersection, a nexus of text-context relations, okay? Therefore, when I study a discourse, what I always have to establish for every statement to make sure that the statement is going to be meaningful is, if you wish, the interpretative context of those statements. And what a critical project then depends on and hinges on is how successfully we can establish, okay, the relevant context, okay, the context relative to which, okay, a statement that I am trying to push to the foreground is going to resonate with some familiarity, and coming to another cultural space, okay, it is even more important because I am more likely to speak to the void. Okay, so therefore, if you wish, it's also a very important power dynamics in cross-cultural or transnational feminist research projects as well, like how much and who are expected to work a lot on this interpretative context before we can get round to the point that we are eventually going to make. And in actual fact, when this most recent publication, I was sort of like mentioned in connection with, i.e., my work in the Zaglos edition of queer theory. In the process of the editing, I said to one of my editors in an email, like, you know, it's really absurd that I am given the same amount of words to get across my ideas as someone who is writing about, shall we say, the US context. Because in general, it is more likely that you don't have to explain things like who is the president of the United States, whereas I have to explain who is the prime minister of Hungary, and not just that, but like if I say that we have got policy X, it says nothing. I have to explain what are the components of that policy, or else everyone else is going automatically to understand that our policy of equal treatment, for instance, I know what it is. No, we don't know what it is. Okay, so in other words, like there are different discourses of public policy. And I can't expect you to know. And even if I can expect that you know, I still can't expect that you are coming with a similar range of intelligibility, okay? Like with similar understandings, perspectives, okay? I.e. similar meanings, right? So anyway, these two moves I made in order already to be doing this work of establishing the interpretative context for the talk itself, right? So now bear with me. I think it is going to be like 45 minutes, we will see. And for a long while, you will just have, okay, this sort of like reformulated, okay, title of my talk. And there now you can see the politics of identity, and you can see the square quotes around identity, because I mean identity as a category, okay, as a concept. Right. And one more thing I would like to say is, like, this is the website of our gender studies program and research group in Szeged, because that's where I am permanently based, right? And if you want to visit it and want to see, like, what we are doing there, it is all in English, because it is this gender program is within an MA degree of English studies, and it actually comprises 3 semesters of 4, right? And on this same website, you can also find that electronic journal that is called TNT on purpose, okay, like as an explosive, okay, but it's also the acronym for the social relations of gender in Hungarian, so it is just a handy coincidence which we could make a nice political use of. Now, as for this icon there, okay, that visual logo, that is the logo of the only Roma NGO in Hungary, okay, whose, at some point I'm going to discuss it, okay, but I just wanted their logo to be visible up there, who are representing various Roma collectives in different parts of the country, fighting the massive, frightening practice of school segregation. In primary schools, actually, so at sort of immediately at the elementary level, okay, at the primary level of education, right? So that is their logo there. Okay, so I have promised to give a talk on the current political situation of the Roma and the existing, preferably feminist, political struggles against the various forms of intensive racism in Hungary. As a feminist linguist whose research is concerned with the relationship between signification, power, and ideology, therefore I have decided to expose the discursive strategies of power articulated in the Hungarian Roma Integration Action Plan. I shall focus on the objectives of the government's education policy in the document in relation to the logic of other government policies and the struggles of the civil organization called Changes for Children Foundation, Esélyt a hátrányos helyzetű gyerekeknek alapítvány, and their acronym is CFCF, and that's their logo. The action plan of the government was submitted to the EU in December 2011 in accordance with the European Commission's recommendation called the National Strategies for Roma Integration of EU Framework for 2020. It was adopted by the EU Employment, Social Policy, Health and Consumer Affairs Council on May 19, 2011. The critique of the Hungarian document I'm going to provide is of particular relevance insofar as the EU framework was approved by the EU summit in June 2011 under the EU presidency of no other country than Hungary. And it was generally referred to in the Hungarian media as the unequivocally recognized success of the Hungarian presidency. In fact, the only thing we could be proud about, if you ask me, that we submitted that document, or under our presidency that document was submitted. Within a broader theoretical and methodological frame, I will raise 3 points for discussion. The 3 points are concerned with 1, deciding on the perspective of critique, 2, acknowledging the relative salience of categories for a given analysis, including the relevance of gender, and 3, with reclaiming the relevance of identity when challenging the revival of nationalist racism, i.e. with the politics of the category of identity. So first of all, let's see the question of how to decide on the perspective of the critique. What should we focus on when discussing the extensive racism against various groups of the Roma in Hungary? When reimagining the politics of location in contemporary society, we need to keep in mind that the positions of the oppressed groups are differential in terms of their stance on the democratic polity. One may argue, in line with many feminist authors on researching women's life, that oppressed groups are epistemologically privileged in that they have a more valid understanding of the conditions of their subordination or marginalization. Sandra Harding, when reconsidering the characteristic features of critical social research in her chapter in an edited volume on Identity Politics Reconsidered, published in 2006, pointed out that identifying with the marginalized does not necessarily mean that the politics of the scientific research agenda are going to be progressive. Her major point is that there are social movements whose critique of the status quo is informed by a conservative agenda. In other words, it is very important for pro-democratic research projects to understand that, quote, standpoint logic shows how to identify and critically analyze a distinctive aspect of power, namely its conceptual practices. Yet, more than pro-democratic groups are marginalized by contemporary political economies, end of quote. Therefore, it is not obvious that scientific engagement with the dispossessed for understanding power relations will deliver any knowledge transgressive to the dominant modes of oppression. I agree with Harding's observation that not all new social movements in the past two decades have been pro-democratic. In other words, the struggle against exclusion from existing cultural goods and services does not inevitably result in pro-democratic agendas. Movements such as the American Patriot Movement or the Hungarian radical paramilitary groups are not only complicit with hegemonic forms of power, but articulate a politics of sheer force. Yet, their agenda is also informed by the logic of critical methodology. They are critical of the system. My mention of the paramilitary organizations is not accidental. They are known for organizing marches in rural Hungary, mostly in the northeast of the country, that is one of the three regions where the Roma population is predominantly concentrated. They justify their presence by reference to the increase of the so-called Roma crime rates, terrorizing the local population. They appear usually at the request of the local mayors, who are members of the most right-wing oppositional party in parliament called Better, which also means writer in Hungarian. And if you have come across in local newspapers, the Hungarian name is Jobbik. Their activity is paired with the reluctance of the police to intervene and refuse to grant permission by reference to the right of free assembly. While the same police, ready, for instance, to ban the gay pride marches in Budapest in the past 2 years under the pretext of maintaining the free flow of traffic. However, coming back to Harding's point, I have to take issue with her on naturalizing the very concept of progress. She does not address the question of how to differentiate between progressive and regressive conceptual and political practices. She simply observes that studying up cannot be politically neutral, since both regressive groups longing for a less democratic past and progressive groups longing for a more democratic future can identify obstacles to achieving their goals in the conceptual practices of modern sciences in their philosophies. This was a quote from her. At this point, Harding's own argumentation becomes caught up in the ideological work of a modernist discourse, I think. It naturalizes the past versus future orientation divide as if the obvious ground for differentiation between progressive and conservative anti-democratic projects. Her logic articulates complicity with ahistoricizing the meaning of democratic change. This blindness could be troubled by recognizing the importance of self-reflexivity. The strategic struggle against co-optations by dominant conceptual practices, I think, requires not only a social movement, but that movement's self-critical, self-reflexive problematization as well. Self-reflexivity could allow us to see that the so-called standpoint of any critical approach is itself an emerging position, one that is the effect of a textually mediated intersubjective negotiation of power. Therefore, it is never ascribed, nor is it granted on the presumption that we already know what democracy is. It always remains subject to contingent intertextual deconstructions and negotiations with those involved. The corollary of an intersubjective reflexivity is that we do not have to argue that the knowledge of the dispossessed or stigmatized should automatically be embraced, let alone that this embracement is granted and would result in a favorable political agenda. Not that it is a sort of like altogether wonderful claim I make. I think the dangers of embracement have been extensively discussed in feminist scholarship, especially in oral history or autobiographical studies. However, in my experience, reflexivity is less addressed as a matter of interconnectedness. Therefore, I am beginning to develop reflexivity as an intersubjective accomplishment, drawing on Jody Dean's work, Democracy and Other Neoliberal Fantasies, that was published in 2009. Dean is concerned with the depoliticizing consequences of the conflation of NGOs' claims to power with a public testimony of harms endured. She focuses on contemporary US political discourse on the left. I started this work in my recent study that was just published by Zaglus and edited by Whitlock and Mesquita. And today I am adopting my reading of Dean's concerns to critical scholarship with a more general frame. I argue that the ease with which the allegedly sympathetic scholar assumes the position of the victim by virtue of the sameness of their identity, rather than aspiring to the position of the political victor, grows out of a prominent strain in contemporary politics, namely the rights discourse associated with movements for civil rights, women's rights, and the rights of sexual minorities. In Dean's view, this strategic use of discourses of rights is at odds with the history of NGOs' fight for power and counter-effectively subverts those movements, activist spirits, resulting in a double bind for the victim. To speak at all, they have to demonstrate how they are harmed, I would say how much they are harmed, and must speak as those who are losers. The gain of the critical scholar, though, may consist in the ability to imagine herself to be always morally correct, for who can deny the suffering of the victim? I agree with Dean and contend that such an act disowns political responsibility on the grounds of one's weakness in the face of institutional power and may play into the hands of the institutions in dominance. What is more, I am convinced that in the current process of centralization of state power in Hungary, the scholar's reluctance to act politically can invite a taste for cruelty, to use Dean's concept, in the name of law and order, resulting in further forms of discrimination. Extending Dean's logic, the decision to approach the particular NGOs and negotiate the research project may be an inevitable first step for us to mobilize the intersectionality of identity. It may result in the displacement of the imaginary homogenized identity of the traumatized victim. Furthermore, this negotiation could preclude the scholar's seamless assumption of the victim's position that holds out the liberal fantasy of delivering justice. Secondly, in accordance with my concern about the politics of location, I would like to emphasize the importance of considering that categorization practices may operate in different ways around gender and sexuality and race or any other social dimension of power relations. Consequently, gender, as a particular category of analysis, does not assert its meaningfulness in and of itself, but becomes more or less meaningful within the available frames of intelligibility. To expose its logic in the context of racism, we may even need to bracket gender temporarily. In short, what I am concerned with in my new project is the implications of the acknowledgement of relative situatedness for conceptualization. It might be the case that feminist analyses would encourage us to read Roma exclusion automatically in terms of relations of power differentials between women and men. Yet, women-men relations may not be imbued with power differences in racist processes as the most immediate dimension of critical potential. Without denying that from a relatively more mitigated perspective, gender distinctions may be as salient as that of race, the segregational effects of the Hungarian strategy document on social inclusion do not lend themselves immediately to gender distinction. In short, when analyzing the actual events from the perspective of the social processes of categorization, it is important to consider first whether we run the risk of overlooking or minimizing the importance of racial or ethnic relations if and when we automatically assume and put primary focus on sex-gender relations. My point is similar to the proviso made by Charlotte Davis back in 1996, who, in her paper on the role of women in nationalist movements, argues that women's involvement is not only a matter of overt, explicit visibility in the actual political movements via their actions, but also a matter of the relatively more covert, mitigated significance or values assigned to them as women. Since Roma women's actual involvement and prominence in the civil movements against educational segregation in Hungary is high, we cannot say that they are underrepresented, that they should be confined to a secondary supportive role. However, in the context of the general feminization of education in Hungary, where men are nevertheless extremely overrepresented in decision-making positions, we may assume that gender relations are of a covert power dynamic. Hence, in the Roma civil organization, the female leader's remarkable determination and commitment is not necessarily made more convincing if I, as an outsider researcher, decide to go ahead and highlight, first thing, the gender relations characterizing the division of labor in the NGO. Given the pressures of patriarchal expectations of women in the country, it is even more paradoxical that gender seems to be perceived as a relatively more subtle ideological barrier to be critiqued in the context of racist exclusion. Therefore, in the current political context, where the absence of women from political movements would practically go unremarked by the majority of the population, academic or non-academic alike, it is very important to consider whether it is worth our while arguing for the unconditioned salience of gender as an analytical category in a feminist project. I am not arguing to give up feminist critique, but to look elsewhere, i.e. to turn to racialization in order to eventually be able to voice gender-based inequalities as well. To expose the racist containment of feminist practice, we need to acknowledge the differential structural position of inequalities. So my second point concerns the revisioning of the transformative capacity of feminism as a politics of gender in relation to other totalities of social formations. What we can adopt from feminist scholarship is its commitment to subverting and transforming binary thinking, to be able to will to look elsewhere for eventually seeing gender. To expose the logic of gender discrimination in racism, we may need to bracket it temporarily. To explore the particular rubric of national identity, I am reflecting on the racist dispositions of the Hungarian majority state institutions and discourses against whatever becomes stigmatized as gypsy. The focalization of the ethnically stigmatized, I hope, should show the need for the politicization of identity for non-stigmatizing progressive political agendas. I will keep education policies and their contestations in the center, since it has emerged as the most prominent ideological state institution in contemporary social struggles over Roma access to belonging in Hungary. As a linguist, the immediate aim of my analysis is to expose a distinctive aspect of power, that is, its conceptual practices as articulated in the Roma Action Plan that the Hungarian government submitted in December 2011. Well, on that date, the Secretariat of State for Integration, Ministry of Public Administration and Social Justice, sent the National Strategy of Social Inclusion to the European Commission. The government immediately proudly announced in a press release that Hungary was the first to comply with the European Framework for Roma Integration. Shortly after, this same secretary was promoted Minister of Human Resources, in office ever since. On the occasion of his promotion, tellingly, he referred to his ministry as a mini-government in the government, and not without reason. Education, culture, health, and social welfare all belong in the same portfolio since January 2012, headed by a minister who temporarily has suspended his pastoral duties in the Calvinist Church. I would like to highlight 3 points about the document, always in their relation to the social context. Above all, there was no civil organization participating in the production of the national strategy. Secondly, there have been several laws and policies since the inauguration of the current government that affect the poor, the majority of whom is Roma, in ways contrary to the alleged values of the national strategy of integration. And thirdly, there have been several bids financed by EU funds that explicitly contradict the declared values in the government document. As for the exclusion of civil organizations, there is a general tendency to preempt the very meaning of civil organizing from below. The government brings about a system of shadow quasi-civil organizations and then invites those as if the only civil organization or the one they declare legitimate. In the case of the Roma integration document, for instance, the particular quasi-civil organization was the Roma Coordination Summit. It was invented on the occasion of the action plan itself, although there exist other institutions. For one, there is the National Roma Parliament that came about as an independent political body. However, over the past 2 years, this parliament has not made any public appearance in relation to any of the issues, laws, or policies affecting the Roma or the strategy document itself. It has come to be a virtual institution whose power potential seems to be contained successfully through its leaders' membership in the Fidesz faction in parliament. And here I have to say Fidesz is, okay, the ruling party at the moment in Hungary. The government, in fact, is playing around with the rhetorical space of calling the imposed organizations civil instead of non-government. They mobilize the nominalist frame of meaning where concepts are seen to directly refer to something that exists prior to their naming. All they need to do, I mean the government, is keep repeating the terms, proving the existence of the autonomous relations between those top-down organizations and the state. I am sure you must have heard more about the Peace March, for instance, back in January 2012 in Budapest, in support of the Hungarian government's fiscal policies. The participants of the march were walking with the slogan on their banner, "We won't be a colony of the EU." The march was organized by the so-called Civil Cooperation Summit. And please also note that all these top-down, from above imposed quasi-civil organizations are always called summit. Okay, it's sort of like, that's the point where there is sort of like the slippage, Derrida would say. Well, a civil organization would never call itself a summit. Okay, it's more like the political discourse of institutional thinking, right? Now, this Civil Cooperation Summit is the showcase of the top-down imposition of civil organizations. And here I show you the photo that was taken of this peace march, a civil organization in support of the government. Okay, that is also sort of like pretty paradoxical. And you can see the banner, okay, in the tricolors of the Hungarian flag, and it reads Nem leszünk gyarmat, i.e. we won't be a colony. Right? Okay. The chair of this civil organization is the same person as the chair of the government fund that is in charge of running bids and making decisions on other civil organizations' applications and projects. Well, he could immediately channeled a lot of government money towards this march, which is apparently not sponsored. Okay? This is a civil organization, actually, on taxpayers' money. Okay? Supporting the government's agenda. Actually, the Peace March just received the Pro-Civil Hungary Award. Just received, like, 2 weeks ago. It was, the award was founded in 2005 by Fidesz politicians who were at the time in opposition. According to the statute of the award, it is for strengthening Hungarians and Hungarian culture in the EU and for integrating Hungarian culture all over the world. So it's a really nice nationalist award. Okay? The award was presented by the Minister of Human Resources himself, I have already mentioned, okay? Most importantly, one of the key figures marching in the front row in the picture, him, with his hand saluting people, okay, is the journalist and a close friend, and a close friend of the Hungarian Prime Minister, who the other day published the infamous article in the right-wing radical daily paper called Magyar Hírlap, okay, that categorizes Roma people as animals. Right? So, and I have to say this because it is not just that radical right-wing party, that small faction in parliament, that is doing racism. Okay? It is a nice division of labor. And that's why I went into all these details, okay, establishing this interpretative context for you to make this statement about that guy. Okay, and to understand that when racism, okay, is sort of like this powerful, it is only the peak of an iceberg. It is a system. It's a network. Okay? That is maintained. Now, let's go back to the analysis of the document. The dominant logic of the document's argumentation, ironically, lacks the general framework of human rights that is so prominent in the EU recommendations. It is a 120-page long document with no mention of the prohibition of discrimination, and there is only a single page included in it that discusses the requirement of equal treatment. For instance, the EU document starts with the opening statement that says, that mentions the 12 million Roma in Europe suffering from discrimination and exclusion. Against this, the Hungarian document frames the strategy as a matter of poverty, the most urgent problem in Hungary, it says. And the poor should include the Roma by extension, but without the document drawing any distinctions between them. And this conflation works against the Roma. This is why, unlike the EU document, there is no mention of any statistics in the Hungarian strategy, okay? We don't know how many Roma people are involved, okay, or should be targeted, if you wish, by this integration policy. All this lack when the government was summoned, okay, by a few, okay, voices of critique. They refuted, okay, the critique, cynically referring the few journalists asking this question back to political correctness, i.e. they would not want to say, like, how many Roma people could be potentially involved in Hungary, because that would not be politically correct. Now, if there are no statistics in the document, I thought that I would bring you some to understand the scale of the matter. Okay, so here is some statistics. And what you also have to understand that these statistics, okay, over the past 20 years should be always read against the overall population of Hungary, which is 10 million. Okay, so relative to 10 million Hungarian, out of the 10 million, okay, according to the 1990 census, there were, okay, so many people, okay, who identified as Roma in response, okay, to the question, okay, which is estimated to be 32% of the total Roma population. Okay, so it's
how many Roma out of this 10 million Hungarian? How many?
Okay, so in 1990, then for instance, it was something like 500,000, and out of the 500,000, okay, 142 blah 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 would self-identify as Roma. Okay, so the only way to establish the statistics is always through self-identification. Okay, don't ask me how they estimate the figure. Okay, so at the bottom you can see from where I have taken the estimate figures as well, and that is a national research agency. Okay. In according to the 2001 census, okay, you could say like it's approximately the same number of people who self-identified as Roma, because it's like 33-34%, but this 33-34% now represents, okay, 190,000 of the population. Okay, so then it is something like 600,000, okay, of the 10 million, okay, who would self-identify as Roma in 2001. Now, and then we arrive at, okay, 2011, okay, to the census, which was sort of like administered all over the EU, and there is no data. Now, on the one hand, okay, we can, and by now, okay, the estimated population actually is anywhere between 800,000 and 1 million, so 10%, okay, of the population, okay? But it is politically not correct to understand the scale, okay, of the issues in front of us, okay? Now, why don't we have data now at the beginning of 2013? On the one hand, surprise, surprise, because the Hungarian institutions have not processed the material yet. And this is unheard of anyway. But they have not processed it. But on the other hand, even if they had processed, okay, the questionnaires, we wouldn't have any figure. For the first time, this census was under the was administered by the current government, okay, and they interfered in the questions. And here comes what they did to the questions, okay? And what they did to the questions was sort of like problematized immediately by the Hungarian Ombudsman of Basic Rights, okay? And the Ombudsman of Basic Rights wrote up a report giving voice to his concerns about the principles of the census. About the principles of the questions, okay, how they were put together in the census. He observes a telling contradiction in the questions or across the questions. On the one hand, out of the three groups of Hungarian Romani people, only the Beas group is identified in the questionnaire offered for self-identification. The other two, the Ola group speaking Roma and the Hungarian speaking group of Rumongos, are left out altogether as possible categories of ethnic belonging. While, on the other hand, ethnic groups like avars and Huns, if you have heard about Attila the Hun, okay, are explicitly mentioned, okay, to ask of people if they identify, self-identify as avar or Hun. Okay. So, we don't want to know of them, okay? If they don't figure in the statistics, they don't exist. Anyway, as simple as that. Furthermore, the Hungarian document of integration, instead of talking about people being excluded, it talks about them as getting excluded, okay? As if by chance. Getting implicates the disposed as the grammatical subject of their own exclusion at the same time. Okay. Although the grammatical subject is not the same as the logical agent of exclusion who is to get the Roma in the situation, it is the grammatical subject, the vaguely implied Roma, that may be associated with getting themselves in segregation. This rhetorical division of labor between the grammatical subject of a sentence and the logical subject of an action results in the mitigated covert act of victimization. Similarly, the document prefers to mention catching up for the political objective of the action plan instead of having them catch up. Getting them catch up, okay? However, the conflation of subjects this time saves the face of the implied author of the document. Catching up implies the Roma as individual actors who should act to make their own situation better, while the causative construction, having them catch up, if it were there, it would categorize the act as a social practice that should necessarily involve institutions and, by extension, the government's responsibility. As a result of the two, okay, the strategy can be mobilized as an explicit linguistic means of victimization. Against this ideological meaning production, the document can naturally draw then on the most prevalent racist discourse of Roma criminality, because it does, as if an act of sympathy, and argue that the population suffering from multiple drawbacks, including the Roma, are not only the source of criminals. Okay? So some of them deserve some attention, probably. To produce the biased edge of the appeal, the document only casually mentions, in a single statement, the systematic presence of hate speech and serial homicide of racist hatred the Roma are exposed to. And they don't deal with it. Just mention their existence. That's it, in the 120 pages. My second point about the broader context of policies of welfare that works against the alleged objectives of the Roma strategy as a result of the strategic use of stigmatization. The most problematic move in this regard is the fact that the value of equal payment for equal work has been taken out of the new Hungarian constitution, which is not called constitution anymore. As we know, it is called basic or foundational, literally foundational law, whatever that means. This goes hand in hand with the actual abuse of the principle via, i.e. the principle of equal pay for equal work, via the recent introduction of the so-called public labor, which means that after 3 months of unemployment benefit, everyone, okay, is forced, okay, to sign up for public labor in the local municipality if there is anything on offer by the local municipality, yet they can't do that for more than 10 months every year. Furthermore, okay, the scheme of this public labor does not earn any social benefit for the employee. Social benefits such as healthcare and pension. Okay? These factors are completely silenced and overlooked by the document of integration, while according to the most recent statistics, 80% of the adult Roma population is unemployed in the country. So they are the potential segment of society, the potential group of people who are going to be these public workers, which, in my understanding, is the late modern form of slavery. It would be of extreme importance in these circumstances to integrate, therefore, the children into the education system and secure some employment for Roma children that may result in some economic integrity and perhaps eventually in integration as well. Yet the document is not concerned with that. This point takes me to the worst part of the document. It concerns the actual objectives of the government's education policy. The EU strategy recommends the integration of Roma students not only into education per se, but into quality education. Okay, it's literally, that's what it is talking about. The Hungarian document simply vaguely speaks of the Roma catching up, while the new Hungarian law on education has very explicitly lowered the obligatory age of education last year from 18 to 16 years of age. And actually, originally, the proposal was 14. I think cynically, so that they can say, like, well, we are not that bad. From 14, we raise it up to 16. Hmm? And then nobody talks about, like, but it was 18. So the government has reduced, the obligatory age of education, but at the same time has restructured the education system itself in the direction of an elitist exclusion in the name of flexibility of future employment and, as a result, reinforced the system of 4 or 6 years of grammar school, 4 years of comprehensive school, and 3 years of vocational training. The latter, in fact, allows for child labor at the age of 15 in the name of training in the floor, in the trade, and provides minimal education of general subjects and only in the first year of the curriculum, with no foreign language learning, of course, at all. Added, and this is the future generation of, okay, skilled workers. Added to this elitism, there is no government financial funds available for the so-called alternative schools anymore, although they are the only institutions that secures the integration of disadvantaged children. So in the state system, there is no systematic attendance to that need. It was, so to speak, sort of like outsourced to these foundations, and now these foundations don't get any money whatsoever from the government. And what I want to show you at this point, okay, is a video. And this video actually was uploaded on YouTube in mid-December last year. And since it was uploaded in December the 10th, okay, there have been so many viewings. And this YouTube video on Inda Video, okay, which is like sort of like an alternative indie media site, okay, is up there in order to attract the attention of the general public and to raise money, because as of January the 1st, 2013, they have no support from the state coming. And they are showing what they are doing. And I thought that I would bring this video to you also because this is the only school actually in the country, and it is very unique. It's in Budapest, in Csepel, in the Csepel district of Budapest. And this is an integrated school from primary to the secondary level. Okay? And sort of, and children can go there. They don't have to be there permanently like in a boarding school, but when the need arises, okay, then temporarily they can go there and they can have shelter there if they can't stay with their parents because the parents, for instance, can't pay for their rent and become homeless temporarily or become chronically ill. So it's a very flexible system anyway. And it is a school of integration in the sense that children in need, okay, they are not synonymous with Roma children, even if the majority are Roma, okay, they all go there together. Okay, and I will show you a bit of it. It's in Hungarian, but I want you to see the school, okay? And I want you to see the interaction. I think the interaction comes across. The powerful civil organization fighting against Roma children segregation in the sense of an NGO and not just a from above civil organization, Opportunities for Disadvantaged Children Fund, okay? In fact, is the only organization of its kind in the country to date. It represents, to represent the immense work they have to undertake, I mention two of their most recent successes. Okay, so what they do, like there is this school, the only one that is in danger, and against this, okay, the NGO is fighting the existing public school system that is full of cases of segregation, okay? And I give you two examples of their legal court cases where they, after 3-4 years of systematic fight in court, which is preceded by another, usually 2 years of gathering information, convincing the parents to dare to stand up or to feel that it is worth standing up, okay, and come along to testify in court. So the eventual verdict, okay, usually means anywhere between 5 to 7 years of work, one case, right? So now I would like to mention two of their most recent successes. One is the court decision in December 2012, deciding that the only primary school in a small village in the northeast of Hungary called Gyöngyöspata is obliged to stop segregation in the school that existed since 2004. The segregation amounted to separating the two floors in the school building on ethnic grounds and to excluding all Roma children from the school canteen and the swimming pool. The actual court case to fight took 2 years. The other eventually successful case is the court decision in September 2011. It was on the primary school in Kerepes, which is near Budapest, where the school segregated so-called problem children, all of them in one class, and they were expected to go to school only twice a week for 4 years. The two cases are representative of the kind of advocacy work the NGO is engaged in on a daily basis. Finally, I have come to the third point I wanted to touch upon, and it's going to be a short one. Against the other two points, I want to argue that Roma identity is a kind of cultural capital in itself. As such, we cannot dismiss it altogether and say that self-identifying as Roma is inherently an act of exclusion, no matter what. Instead, I want to underscore the political relevance of identity for people who are deprived of self-worth in the social imaginary of the dominant culture. In short, I am contesting the conventional wisdom in contemporary cultural and queer studies that the central status of identity should have been exhausted. I argue that fighting nationalism in contemporary Hungary rather requires reimagining the explanatory power of the category of identity and negotiating a discourse of identity that is articulated from a post-identity position in Michael Milner's sense of the word. In the 2004 special issue of Critical Inquiry on the Future of Critical Thinking, Homi Bhabha singles out nationalism as the key concern and concept of the millennium. And I agree with that. Yet, against the power of the nation state, he simply offers, quote, the careful virtue of tolerance, end of quote, and the, quote, imaginative virtuosity of identification that we humanists, artists, poets, historians, literary scholars enact every day in our attempts at writing, reading, and interpretation, end of quote. I think this formulation is simply voicing Bhabha's self-congratulatory agenda. It is similar to the fantasy of being always morally correct, as exposed by Jody Dean. It can take place by virtue of conflating words and action, granting the sameness of the two forms of knowledge. I argue that fighting nationalism in contemporary Hungary requires a different approach to categorization, including identity. We should understand that imagining identity from the perspective of idem, same identity, is only a particular mode of its articulation, even if the dominant mode. It undermines the explanatory power of the category, even if it is inflected favorably, like in Bhabha's thinking, or unfavorably, like in the discourse of stigmatization. Against the general depletion of identity, argues Milner, quote, one particular identity rubric, i.e. national identity, has long been under deep critique within the field of cultural studies for the ways it has distorted knowledge, but post-identitarian conceptualizations of race, ethnicity, gender, class, and sexuality are undoubtedly central to the questions we in American studies ask and to our political, even ethical, self-understanding. In fact, it's difficult to imagine it in any other way, end of quote. Insofar as nationalism is a powerful force today, and I think it is, what we need to do is not to give up the relevance and explanatory power of the category of identity. It does not suffice simply to say that nationalism and ethnic belonging, fighting it, are both articulated to mean an identity that is bound to exclude. We need to remind ourselves of Gay Rubin's Traffic in Women and say, identity is identity. What makes any category to mean anything particular is the relationship it comes to be caught within in the course of the use of the concept. The totalizing dismissal of identity as inherently stigmatizing is a logical corollary of the neoliberal attempts at tolerance performed by Bhabha's middle-class intellectuals. I would rather turn to Robin Wigman, who discusses the anti-racist intellectual agenda in contemporary U.S. feminist scholarship. She takes issue with the way, quote, white women talk race only to perform their anti-racism for other white women, producing not new ways of understanding the construction of white subjectivities, but highly symbolic burnings in which their own whiteness is essentially purified. End of quote. I argue that always already assuming that gender is the category to start social critique can run the risk of such a strategic self-justification for feminist scholars. End of my talk. Thank you for your attention.